Hello, this is Louise Jameson, and you're listening to The Sirens of Audio.
G'day audiophiles, you are listening to The Sirens of Audio, the podcast that explores the universe of Doctor Who in the audio medium. My name is Dwayne.
And my name is Philip. G'day everyone, g'day Dwayne.
Mate, there's another good one coming up for you today. We're very excited about this one. Today we are going to be chatting with the lovely Katie Manning, who has just recently celebrated her 50th anniversary in Doctor Who, Philip.
I know, it's an amazing achievement, isn't it? 50 years doing anything. It's not just it's 50 years since she started. She's, it's 50 years and she keeps going back to it. And, especially the last 15 years, she's played Joe Grant an awful lot.
Absolutely. So I thought instead of jumping down the rabbit hole, we'll stay on topic today, Philip, and we'll talk for a few minutes about some of our memories of Katie, some of our thoughts on her work in audio. But the question I want to ask you, do you remember the first time you ever saw Katie in person? Because she lived in Australia for a long time, so us Australian fans got to see her a lot throughout the 80s and 90s. So what do you have any memories of seeing her for the first time?
Yeah, I can't think when was the first time I saw her, because as you say, I've seen her a lot. I've actually met her a lot. I have a whole series of photos of being hugged by her from quite a young age. So the first time must have been about 15 or 16, and I would have got an autograph from her, but I'm not sure I would have talked to her. I guess my memories. This convention that we did with Rob Sheehan and India Fisher, and I'm trying to think when that was, but that was quite a while ago now, probably about 18 years ago, and that would have been the first time.
That would have been about 2005, I reckon.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds about right. And that was the first time I probably spent a lot of time with her, because I would have had a meal with her at that convention. Both of us interviewed Rob Sheehan, so I sort of started the interview.
Both of you?
Well, I was down to interview Rob. But because she's friends with him as well, she decided she was going to burst on midway through. So I sort of did the first half of the interview, and midway through she sort of bursts on and, in her typical Katie way, takes over. So we sat down with a drink to work out how we're going to do that and plan that out and who's going to ask what sort of things. That's probably the first time I sort of had a lot to do with her. But it's just always been just a bundle of energy, fun, always. So what about you, Dwayne? Yeah. When did you first see our meta?
The first time I saw Katie was, I still remember the year, 1990. It was Whovention. I think it was the second Whovention. Or was it the first? No, I think it was the first Whovention, because they'd had a big convention previously, about 2 years earlier, but it was called something else. So this was Whovention 1. And the headline guest for that convention was Nicholas Courtney. So I was just a very young and nervous and shy fan. And I saw Nick Courtney for the first time, it was just like, oh, wow, this is just amazing. Incredible experience to see him for the first time. But of course, on the second day of the convention, Katie came in and they were both there together. I remember that he sat down, there was a chair for Katie, but no, that was not on. Katie just jumps on Nick Courtney's lap and they do the whole panel with her sitting on his lap. It was just really, really nice. It was like two old mates getting back together, reminiscing about those old days. And I was just bedazzled by her. Yeah. So that was Whovention. I think I saw her again maybe 10 years later. She would often pop up at club day events and things like that, because she lived in Sydney. So
yeah, she was the patron of the Doctor Who Club of Australia. Still is the patron.
Still is, yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, we got to see her an awful lot. One of the most interesting and bizarre times that I saw her was when she brought Barry Crocker, because obviously she was with Barry Crocker for a while. Were you at that one, Philip, when Barry came?
I was.
And he jumped up on stage, and sang the theme to Neighbours.
Yes.
I thought, what am I doing? Were you at that one?
I was there. I don't remember. Well, I guess I would have seen you, but didn't, yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't really know you then. She is still with Barry Crocker, even though it's a long-distance relationship.
But, oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, that was the last thing I expected to do, was to go and see Barry Crocker. But he's just as mad as Katie. So I guess that's why they get on.
I mean, she's directed him in a musical and a play, and he's directed her as well. So I don't know how well that goes in terms of trying to direct each other.
Right.
Yeah, lots of success there.
Yeah. Sounds like lots and lots of fun in that relationship. So, and I think one time after that, who ventured, it was my job to look after Katie backstage before she came on to Whovention. So it's very interesting. When you see her, she's very, very outgoing, but she is actually quite nervous before these things happen. And I do recall her being a little bit nervous backstage, ready to go on. And yep, she went through that TARDIS and went full into Katie Manning show. It was really awesome. That was Whovention, the Whovention before the one you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, 2003.
I was surprised that, as I said, sitting down with her, she's very businesslike, very matter of fact, you know, do this, da da da, and then but then switches on in performance. Because, you know, a lot of what people see is the performance, Katie. Mm. As opposed to just who she is, which is, yeah, she does have a sane blind side. She's blind as a bat.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
So the first time we actually heard her in Big Finish, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Philip, but was it with the Excellus series?
It was. That's her first time.
That's where Iris Wildtime appeared for the first time in Excellus Dawns with Anthony Head.
2002, that's right.
Yeah. So what was your impression of that character?
I love Iris Wildtime. I think she's hilarious. So I didn't know her at all, and I know she had books or something. I think Iris existed in another life. Is she New Adventures or something? So I know lots of people knew who she was. So she had been in some books and things beforehand, and so this was Big Finish, you know, moving her like they did Benny into the first series. So I had no expectations. I'm not sure I would have picked it was Katie, because Katie is just astounding with voices.
She is,
and quite regularly
one of the best.
You know, it just, you wouldn't know it was her, and this, you know, this accent and, you know, loveys and all these things. It was just a scream. And of course, that's back when Gary Russell decided he wasn't going to put on, you know, he wasn't going to have any past doctors or recast anyone. And so all those early companions were never going to be used. And so that's why they were able to be used in other roles. And, you know, a lot of the early companions came in to the show and had other roles to play. And they decided to cast Katie Manning as Iris Wildtime. And she did a lot of Iris, even in the main range. She did one with Colin Baker, The Wormery.
Oh, The Wormery, yeah. But I think the Excellus series came out even before that, didn't
it? Yeah, it did. Yeah, Excellus was
before
first.
Before The Wormery, so.
Yep, and then they did some Iris Wildtime individual stories, and then The Wormery came out. So, yeah, and hopefully...
And do you remember what the first story that she appeared in as Jo Grant was? That would have been a Companion Chronicle, wouldn't it?
It was, and I can tell you what it is because I've got it here, because I'm ready to talk about it, The Doll of Death in 2008.
Oh, yes.
So it took 6 years of her actually being with Big Finish before she actually played Jo Grant.
That's right, because did she appear in a Benny story as well during that time, in another Excellus story? That Plague Herds of Excellus?
Plague Herds of Excellus, yep. That was as well. So she went with, it was Peter Davison, wasn't it?
Peter Davison was Excellus Dawns. Yeah.
Excellus Dawns, and then she did the one with Lisa Bowman, so it's just her and Benny.
Yeah.
And then the individual stories as well. And as I said, it wasn't until 2008 she got to play Jo Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And then lots of Companion Chronicles. And then finally they brought her back for, what was it? So she did Gallifrey 4, Lady Bruiser, Dorian Gray, Scorchies, but yeah. Hopefully, we'll be able to chat with Elizabeth Kane.
She was Lady Barusa, was she?
She was, in Gallifrey 4.
I don't even remember that. It's been so long since I've heard it. That makes me want to go back and listen to it right now.
Okay, well, you go, and I'll just sit here and chat with Katie.
No. All right, cool. So then she went back. Yeah, she went back to TV as Jo Jones, and then she's been back with. She's been back in the Third Doctor range ever since that began.
Yeah,
you look like the man with your facts and figures, so you probably know when that began more than I do.
I do. Let's go down. So Unit Assembled was 2017. The first Third Doctor Venture was 2015.
Yeah. Okay, so not that long ago.
What, really? 6 years now, though?
Yeah, relatively, though.
And then she's done some Torchwoods and, of course, Masterfall at the start of this year.
Of course, the Torchwood, the Green Life. That was awesome. I loved it.
Yeah, and also the Lives of Captain Jack. She's right. in as well.
Yep. Excellent.
Wow, does that mean I'm now Unit Scientific Advisor?
No, not quite. I'll introduce you to her now.
Ogrons, you were actually chased by Ogrons while riding a space trike. And the maggots, proper wriggly giant maggots. Giant maggots that turned into giant flies. And Omega, you went to a universe made entirely out of antimatter, which is completely and utterly impossible, actually properly mad, but you went there anyway. And you didn't die or blow up or anything.
Perhaps you'd like to have a little sit down, darling.
Sit down. I need to dance.
Please don't.
Oh, Jo Jones. The actual Jo Jones.
Yes? Well, that's me, sweetie.
I'm feeling a bit giddy. Yeah,
we've noticed. Miss Jones, this is our scientific advisor.
Hi.
She'll be accompanying you on the Charybdis.
Oh! Great. We'll have days for you to tell me all your stories.
Lovely.
Oh, well, hopefully it'll take my mind off the seasickness. I'm hopeless on water. I once threw up on a pedalo.
Great. Ooh, loving the velvet jacket.
It seemed appropriate. 1 in 11 million. 1 in 11 million.
What's that, darling?
The odds of dying in a plane crash. Sorry, I'm not normally this bad, but it's been a bit of a week. Of course, the odds of dying in a unit plane are ever so slightly higher, but let's not think about that.
They don't let you out much, do they?
Oh, I do loads of field work. I'm just not always sure about the travelling part.
Oh, listen, this isn't travelling. I'll tell you about travelling. Do you know, I once trekked from Tarapoto to Lima entirely by donkey.
Why?
I'm not sure now. Maybe the frogs didn't fancy the bus ride.
The frogs?
Yes, a rare species from a street market. Do you know the vendor was making them into smoothies?
Smoothies?
I know! So, anyway, we'd grabbed the whole aquarium of these rare little darlings and we were just hot-footing it out of there, you know, because we wanted to put them back into the wild. But then, well, of course, we were hit with the problem of the toucan.
Actors have had as diverse and interesting a career and successful a career as our guest today, performing in theatres and television across the UK, Australia and America, with dozens of voices and characters, and success not only as an actor, but also a writer, an interviewer and a director as well. She starred alongside John Pertwee for 3 years, but more than 50 years later is still returning to the role of Jo Grant on both film and audio. I'm so pleased to welcome the one and only Katie Manning. So, Katie, welcome so much. Thank you for joining us on Sirens of Audio.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. And, you know, my little heart beats double because, you know, Australia is such a huge part of my life and I'm always grateful for everything that it gave me. Now it's giving it to my children. I have my twins over there and my grandchild over there and, of course, my partner, Barry Crocker.
So, first, I actually wanted to say one of the things I'm so appreciative of you for, Katie, is in terms of how positive you've stayed through the whole pandemic. Your tweets almost daily encouraging people to care for each other. So thank you for all that you're doing there.
Oh, yeah, thanks, look, Katie. It's an absolute pleasure. You know that whenever I'm asked what was the best thing that ever came out of Doctor Who for me, I always say, and I mean it absolutely, it might sound a bit weird, but it's absolutely true. It's the fans. I have met some remarkable people, you know. I mean, also we know that so many fans went on to be directors, writers, so it inspired people. But also I met people who had very traumatic upbringings or difficult illnesses during their life. And it was this wonderful door that opened of opportunity to be able to give back to them, to thank them, and also open the world for me to so many other lives and things that people go through. And, you know, it really means so much to me to be able to hopefully uplift people through these unbelievably difficult times that we have never experienced anything like it before. So if I can make people smile or lift them up a little bit, that's what I want to do.
Well, you'll certainly do that. Lots of people. So you spent a large time, 28 years, I think, you were in Australia for. So, yeah, we feel like we own you.
Longer than that. Came over in 1982 with very, very sick children, two suitcases, planning, because it was the only place that I knew one person. And I thought, well, this is the right climate that the doctor suggested may help the children into a long road to recovery. And so I did. Well, that 6 months, I came back again. I did a play in the West End. The children were sick again. I won't go into all the ins and outs. Nobody needs all that stuff. And so I went back again, and then I started working more. I met Barry. I met the children's stepfather. I met, you know, the children's health started to get better. And I just didn't leave. I did come back and forth, but every time I came back, the children became poorly again. So I thought, this is, you know, and the one thing you do, you have to put your children way in front of everything else, even though I'd left a huge and wonderful career here. I knew my friends would always be here, and they are. I moved it when I got back from Australia. I moved in with a friend of mine when I was doing the Betty Davis play, Me and Jezebel, which is about Betty overstaying her welcome. And I said to my friend, Catherine, darling, I'm just going to be here for about 6 months, you know, because I don't know quite what I'm going to do. I ended up by being there for 3 years. So while I was doing the play, her husband said, do you think Katie's taking this rather too seriously?
When you moved over here, it was 82, so Doctor Who at the time was regularly being repeated on the ABC here in Australia throughout that period. That's when I became a huge fan. Were you recognised a lot on the street in Sydney because it was shown so much?
Well, I kept very quiet. I mean, yes, I did get recognised, but, you know, I didn't come over there to say, hello, darlings, I've come to your country and I was in Doctor Who. I came over there to hope that I could get my children's health back. And I said, you know, if I have to carry the crumpets on in the second act, curtsy and leave, you know, that's, I'm happy to do that. But of course, when I started working with people like Salter and so on, you know, I started to get more accepted. I'm not one of these people that comes and makes an announcement, hello, I'm here. But then my memory from 1982, trust me, is not totally focused around Doctor Who. But I, you know, I was always delighted to see the wonderful actors, you know, most of whom I knew, and Colin Baker, who I always said, one day you'd make a great Doctor Who, rest is history, who I'd worked with. But I wanted to see what everybody was doing. But, you know, I know that the children were very embarrassed when they had a couple of teachers say, oh, we love your mother. Well, they were at the age when you just don't say that. Yes, I mean, I was recognised, but, you know, not in the way that I would have been in the UK.
Listen, there's so much we would love to talk to you about, and so much has been covered. You've got such an amazing career, and there's bits of your career I'd actually love to dip into, some of your theatre stuff. But we want to really focus on some of the audio work you've done, particularly. And particularly work with Big Finish, because your range there in terms of roles is huge, not just Joe Grant, of course. So how did you first come to work for Big Finish? How did they approach you? Because once again, it was interesting. We were chatting with Gary Russell recently, and of course he had a policy. He wouldn't recast doctors, and he wouldn't recast people. So therefore, there was no way people like you, with, you know, sadly John being gone, he wasn't going to use you, but he then would start finding new roles. So Iris Wild Time, how did he approach you? How did you end up playing Iris?
Well, coming back as Joe, I told David Richardson, he approached me several times, and I said, why would I do that without John? You know those things you say it just, you know, when asked, I thought, no, why would I do that without John? You know, no, that's, and then they very cleverly got a friend, a friend of mine for so many years, I can't even count. Anyway, so then he very cleverly got hold of this friend of mine, and he said, well, if Jane Goddard, who's married to Rob Shearman, she wasn't at the time, but if we get your friend, will you do? So I said, okay, I'll give it a go. So I played John for years. You know, I did John, Joe, the Brig, the Master, everybody. And then I came back. I can never remember things in linear. You know, it's no good asking me years or this or that because I just don't do it. There's much more interesting things to store in my head than all that. So, you know, I remember the stories, just don't ask me when it happened. And Gary said, oh, I've got this great character I want you to play. And I came back from Australia and I went in and I didn't know anything about Paul Mars or Iris Wildthyme. You know, living in Australia, there's a lot of things we don't know about that are happening here and books and, you know, so on and so forth. And I was so far out of the Doctor Who scene. I'd done a couple of conventions in America and that was it, really. And anyway, so I went into the studio and he said, I said, well, how do you want me to play it? And he said, well, just do something. So I thought, okay. It opened with Iris. She was, I think it was the first one I did was with Lisa Bauman. And anyway, so it opens with Iris, I don't know, removing dewdrops from cabbages at a convent or something like that, singing softly to herself. And for some reason, I have no idea why, because you have to, when you know, so many of these things you do, you're doing on the spot, in the moment. And I just suddenly went, dam, 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 and sort of Iris grew. And I did the very strong northern from all parts of the north accent. And Gary said, that's it, you found her. And I'm just doing three Paul Mars novels. They are insane. And I've got a count now of 47 voices. Wow. So I'll either be locked into a padded room for the rest of my life, or I'll be in the Guinness Book of Records. You know, they've been so wonderful. I've done Dorian Gray. I've done Torchwood, but I did two Torchwoods. A lot of people don't realise I played a character called Mother Nothing, who was this horrendous sort of cockroach-like creature who ate everybody on her planet and was looking for another planet to settle on. She even ate her own children. And then I played Joe Jones with John Barrowman. I have done so many other characters, you know, and of course, you bring Iris back with different doctors. And then, you know, I played Joe Jones and Joe Grant. And quite often at the end of the day, they say, oh, Katie, before you go, can you do a 7-year-old boy with consumption? Because we need an extra voice. And, you know, of course, one of my favorites was the Scorchies, where I actually got to sing as Cool Cat and the Nasty Little Mice. It's the most violent audio I think I've ever done in my entire life. But I played all the characters in that, bar one.
Coming soon from Big Finish Productions. Doctor Who, The Companion Chronicles. The Scorchies.
Joe is making a thing. It's held together with a piece of string. What a lovely thing to sing about Joe making a thing.
Hello, everyone. Hello, everyone. Welcome, one and all, to the Scorchie Show.
Josephine Grant, I'm a friend of the Doctor's, and I've come here to defeat you.
A story!
Oh, dear. I'm no good at stories.
Joe is making a thing. It's held together with a piece of string. What a lovely thing to sing about Joe making a thing.
Twinkle, twinkle, little death. Time to draw your last breath.
Big Finish, you know, who, let's face it, when Doctor Who had its break, which I think did it a lot of good in a lot of ways, they kept everybody going. It's what they've done has just brilliant. They're the most wonderful company to work for. I even did my own play for them, Not a Well Woman, which was the first drama that they'd done of that, you know, that was nothing to do with anything.
I actually wanted to talk to you about Not a Well Woman, because you wrote and performed it originally in America and then did it for audio. I was listening to it today, actually. 26 voices. I was going crazy as well. But what I just wanted to know was so much of that is part of your life. I mean, there's the twins, there's the premature twins, there's moving to a hotter climate. How much is you and how much is story?
Ah, well, there you go. You know, I think for me, I absolutely, you know, it was in my heart to write this. And really, it was to do with sight and how it changes how you are. Because, you know, it's that sort of attitude that if you can't see something, you're not able to be afraid of it. It kind of changes how you live your life. And I was kind of exploring this area, you know, because if you're standing on a cliff and you can't see how far you have to fall, you can't feel fear. And so it was just really interesting how I'd sort of gone through my life this way. And certain things, you know, and it just sort of evolved. So how much of it is me? Quite a lot, because I utilized a lot of my experiences because of the subject that I was trying to get across. I wanted to write something, you know, because I am a very strongly positive creature. And I also wanted to be very truthful about some of the difficulties of being a single mother with very sick and premature children, and how you deal with it positively and constructively rather than making it about you. You have to think very differently. There were lots of elements in there. The only thing that I did separately, because, you know, when I do all these voices, I don't do one lot of voices, then another lot of voices. I actually interact with myself, which is why I'm slightly insane. because that's the way I do it. I was doing that in Australia. I did a lot of animated cartoons and things, and I always just did all the voices, you know, Gloria's House. I just did them all talking to each other. And so when I did that, the only thing that was separate was when I wrote the very naughty rap song, which my son said, my mother, I've never been so proud of you in my life. But I was also making a rather beautiful lampshade for my daughter at the same time. So that's a very split personality for you, isn't it?
I'll say.
but, you know, it was something that was so close to my heart. And I was in LA, and it's not a place that I'm comfortable in. It really isn't. I am not an LA woman at all. And so I felt, what can I do that's so on LA? I know, I'll write the play. And Lisa said to me, she said, you know, because I kept crossing my arms and going, oh, I've not been a well woman. And she said, write it. So I did. And I did two performances of it on stage. Then I came back to England, put it in a cupboard in my friend's house. And then suddenly I thought, because so many changes, so many different people had been involved in it, and I kind of lost the love of it. So I put the original handwritten script away. And then I took it out and I thought, I just talked to Big Finish. I talked to Nick and to David Richardson, and they came over, had a piece of cake and a cup of tea. And I said, listen, if you think this is rubbish, at least you've had a piece of cake. And anyway, so I dropped a whole bunch of pages on the floor, and they said, I said, don't worry, they're not numbered, because I don't write that way. As long as you start on page one and end on the last page, it all kind of works. And within about three pages, they said, we want to do it. So that was that. And I'm very proud of it, to be honest with you. And I hope that in a way that it is strong, and I do think it's uplifting in a strange sort of way.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your Captain John Forbes speaking. We've been advised that all passengers must remain on the aeroplane due to the extremely delicate and dangerous political situation here in Baghdad. We will refuel as quickly as possible. We appreciate your patience in this sensitive situation, as we anticipate an early arrival in Sydney. So please, just sit back, relax, and enjoy the music.
Excuse me. Passengers have been advised to remain on the plane while we refuel. I have two sick children and I am exhausted. But there are armed soldiers surrounding the plane.
I don't care if there's a fucking reign of terror. I'd rather be shot at than sit on this aeroplane for one more minute.
For your own safety, I insist.
Listen, prior to leaving London, first class, only evident by a putrid bottle of evening in Paris, a bird shat on my head, which is supposedly good luck. We had floods on the way to the airport. Then some unctuous little jumped-up ticket collector superciliously accused me of having too much hand luggage. I have twins. He was so rude, I was forced to smack his revolting little bottom with my British passport. The stewardess filled my son's milk bottle with Coca-Cola, which exploded at 35,000 feet. My children have not stopped throwing up since they got on this plane, a plane so hot that if I believed in hell, this would be it. What's a few marauding terrorists compared with this shit?
That's better. Don't leave without us. Thank you, darling. We were escorted by rifle-bearing marauders who shoved us into a jeep. Thank you, sweetheart, and recklessly drove us to the Tin Shed Airport. Kind of you, darling, where we were greeted by other phlegm-clearing marauders. I suddenly was aware that their guns had been lowered to the ground. The soldiers were advancing, getting closer and closer. I held my children defiantly. The soldiers came to a halt. Nothing happened. Was this goodbye? Hang on. My hair. They were all mesmerized by my shocking pink and maroon streaked hair, very effective when defusing marauding terrorists.
I listened to it again, as I said, I listened to today in preparation for talking to you because I wanted to get a handle in terms of, you know, something that you'd written and produced. And one of the things that got me was, having done some research, so many stories were bits of your life. So the twins, the slight difficulty seeing, those kind of things are you. But the thing was, I mean, I don't know in terms of the whole connection with motherhood thing, but you gave people permission to be themselves. So, you know, a mother who doesn't immediately fall in love with her child, you were giving permission for that. So I just thought in terms of, you know, how it's very uplifting, so a really positive story, a lot of humour. I mean, the stuff in and out of wardrobes is hilarious. But you gave people permission to be themselves.
Well, yes, I think sometimes we feel, that I learnt later that you actually, when a child, you can't hold your child, when you can't touch them. And they're covered, you know, their face is covered. You actually, in truth, don't have that connection. But we feel guilty about it. So we do this big thing of, oh, you know, and the sobbing and the crying. But that doesn't change anything. That doesn't help the situation through. And I found later that there were a lot of women who said, I had to pretend because I felt guilty. And I thought, no, let's get, you know, for me, it was important to get rid of that guilt and be very kind of realistic and truthful about it. But as I said in the play, the moment I can hold them in my arms, and that's exactly what happened, the moment that I could hold them, that was it. So, you know, I wanted to look at certain situations that we often felt guilty about, you know. And I, you know, like the loss of her father, you know, that was very truthful. And once again, you know, the way I dealt with it, the way I was brought up is to be grateful rather than walking around making it about me and sobbing and crying. I knew 20 minutes before I walked on stage, and I knew that my father, I could hear my father saying, if you don't get onto that stage right now, I'm going to come back and kill you, you know. and you do your sadness at home, But it was really important to me to show the gratitude that I'd had this remarkable man in my life. And I did the same with my mother. It's the gratitude and the fact that they've touched my life, affected my life, and I wanted to honor his life by doing the best I could with mine. Just a different way of looking at things, because so often we make loss and tragedy and things about us when it should be about, you know, as Daddy said, you know, I'm all right wherever I go if there's either something or nothing. And it's going to be a huge adventure, you know. I'm leaving you behind. And you are the person that has to, because you're not, they've gone, but they're always there. They never leave you. You know, I don't use the dates of loss or anything like that, because every single day, everybody who has gone from my life, and I've lost a lot of people, are in my heart, my mind, and the very fiber of my being with everything that they've given me. And I just spend that time being so grateful.
I mean, the power of a good story is it lets people connect. I was listening to it with my 16-year-old daughter in the car, and we got to the section where you're talking about the babies suck their thumbs because they breastfeed, and then you talk about the twins with tubes up their noses. Does that mean they stick their fingers up their noses? And my 16-year-old just cracked up, and she just kept giggling at this concept of these kids with their fingers stuck up their noses because that's how they were fed. So, yeah, you made a connection with a 16-year-old and just watching her.
It crossed my mind, and because I wanted all the positivity in the world that I could give, and I knew those children were going to be all right. There was never a doubt in my mind when they said 30% chance of survival and then another illness hit them, which nearly wiped them out. Every fiber in my being knew they'd be all right. And humor, some people may think is misplaced, but I think it's really, really important. I really do. I think it's something we have with us, especially when we're going through very difficult times. It's like I always remember the wonderful, funny stories about people that I have said goodbye to. You know, I want to remember them with joy in my heart, not sadness.
Well, I guess there's lots of amazing people that you have worked with closely and lost. John Pertwee, Nicholas Courtney, two springs to mind. So what is it like now acting alongside John Coshaw, Tim Treloar, who are playing those roles? What's it like being Joe with somebody else?
It's really, I mean, once again, I'm going with the humour on this one. It's wonderful because Tim Treloar, I don't know whether you can probably see it in any, we just had this incredible connection, which is, I think, what John and I had. And I think it's a very vital part of the relationship between the companion and the doctor. And we just had this instant connection. And of course, it's John, which we, you know, I help him with, as you know, I was listening and anything that isn't quite there, or all the physicality that you do when you're doing voices. You don't just sort of stand there, you have to physicalize. And he's found it's not just about an impersonation. You have to go beyond the impersonation. You have to find that something extra, and Tim has it, as does John Coleshaw with the Brig. He's found that little something that it's not just about the voice. It goes beyond the voice, and they're both brilliant. So we're standing there, and I think, so it was John Coleshaw, Daisy Ashford, who is playing Caroline Johns, who's Caroline Johns' daughter. And I'm looking around, and I suddenly think, John was way much older than me, and so was Nicholas, right? Suddenly I'm standing there. I'm 75 this October, and I'm there on little tippy toes to find, because don't forget, I have to find Joe's voice, because I lifted Joe's voice even when we did the series. So imagine now I'm having to go up here somewhere. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I'm standing here at 74, right, with these youngsters, and I'm playing the little one. I'm playing the young girl. And it just for a moment, you know, just for a few seconds, you just think, this is so bizarre. You know, people could see this, like, wackiness. But it is a joy, and I get goosebumps, you know, because for fleeting seconds, you kind of go back. And it's you know, it can be really touching, and it's wonderful. And so, yeah, that struck me as really funny. And then I looked at them and I said, now, listen, when I fall off my perch, who's going to play me? Which one of you is going to play me?
Did you actually have any trepidation beforehand, though, before you met Tim? Did you have any concerns about how it might turn out at all?
I had huge trust in Big Finish and David Richardson and Nick Briggs. And I like to be able to put trust out. And also, you know, you do that because that's a much better way to go into things positively. Instead of looking at all the things that, oh, well, maybe it won't be good. Maybe I wanted to go and this is going to be terrific. I'm feeling it. You know, I want to do this. And if it doesn't work out. And it was so that was why it was so vital. As it happened with John Pertwee, that the first time we met, there was just this boom, this little something that you can't explain. And I felt that instantly with Tim. And then when, of course, I was hearing him, I just went, thank you. And I know how impressed John would be, you know, with what he's doing. It's a remarkable job, as is John Culshaw doing the Brig. You know, it's lovely. But I think you have to go into these things with an open heart and huge trust.
Just in the last couple of days, we've been privileged to see a video from Big Finish that's been released of you and Tim answering some Twitter questions. That's only been out a couple of days, and we got to see that spark, and you can see it between you. It's just really electrifying. It's great.
So you kind of get what I'm saying, don't you?
I do.
You know. Yep. Also, my positivity had to be very strong because for Tim, this was, I mean, that's a hell of a character to have to take on. And, you know, so I wanted to be really, really strong and positive and in belief of him. And because our personalities just click, because we're both naughty, I think you can probably tell that.
Yeah.
Much naughtier than sometimes you see. But so were John and I. But, you know, I wanted to be really strong for Tim, and it took seconds before I went, he's perfect. He's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
You do see the success that Tim has taken over, though, because, there was a lot of nervousness about recasting, understandably. So I guess, a lot of fans felt that, you should recast. But the fact that it's just, the series has gone from strength to strength in terms of, the number of box sets that have come out now, and even a box set being about to be released with no original cast members at all. Don't know how you feel about that being left out totally. But just the fact that Tim has so taken on the role and people have accepted that, which is exciting for everyone.
Well, and it's a great relief, I'm sure, to everybody listening that I'm not playing John. Although I had the right feeling for John, I wasn't even going to... I didn't do... an impersonation. I worked from the heart and knowing John. So I got the feeling of John. And nobody ever sort of complained, but it's so much nicer for me as an actress to have Tim there to communicate with rather than me doing all the voices, you know, especially when we added Iris to the mixture as well. I mean, it's wonderful. And I think a lot of fans have suddenly gone, wait a minute, this works with, Tim is just stunningly superb. And John Culshaw too. So I think a lot, how people kind of judge things before they happen. You know, it's like just before we get
to the new
job, he's going, oh, this isn't right, that's not right. And you think, oh, shut up. You know, wait. I keep saying to everybody, don't judge till you know. I never thought of Doctor Who being a female because it had never crossed my mind, for it to be that way. But it's perfect. It works. It's the right actress at the right time. And I think casting should always be, it shouldn't be just because. It should be because that's the right. And she is absolutely the right person. Superb. And Missy, I was so thrilled with that. you know, to have Michelle Gomez play Missy. And that's interesting because if you think of Roger Delgado, they came from the same sort of background. I mean, you know, Delgado and Gomez. But, you know, it's terrific. And we do have to move on and we do have to make changes. And if we go back to the doctor being a male, that's good too. But we should never judge until we see how it pans out.
So Masterful was the big release that started the year off. It feels like a long time ago now. And I must admit, I was very surprised that you suddenly turned up in Masterful. It wasn't really promoted that Jo Grant was going to be there. And in fact, she ends up being this integral part. And it, of course, 50 years celebration of the Master, Jo has to be there.
Oh, yes, that one. But also I've done one with Sir Derek Jacobi, which hasn't been released yet, which was one, because he's sitting there so calm and so cool, being this extraordinary master. And Joe is going through the most traumatic, emotional gamut. But it was a wonderful experience, you know, to do that too. And then to come back with UNIT, you know, and to work with those wonderful people. And, you know, and I love the adventure that Joe twice goes on with. I've done two of those. And I love it when Joe meets Osgood. And they, you know, it's just all so exciting, wonderful. And we should be very grateful to Big Finish for doing all these amazing things, you know, which now go right around the world. It's extraordinary. You know, it just blows my little tiny mind. I never thought I'd be on a postage stamp. I never thought I'd be a plastic figurine with my granddaughter playing with this little plastic figurine and talking about it as grandma. It's just the most amazing program. It really is. And, you know, when you meet people who come over from places like Russia and South America, you know, it's just, I'm just always surprised and thrilled and so happy, because we never thought, well, you don't think when you're doing a show back then that this is going to continue. And, you know, this is going to be, come back and be with you for the rest of your life. I always knew it would be in my memory, but I never thought it would be in my reality. And I remember Barry Crocker getting quite upset one day because he was the big star in Australia. And we went out to dinner and the waiter came up and sort of said, oh, I recognize you. And Barry went, you know, did his sort of, oh, really? and he was looking straight at me. And I said to Barry, you see, you do have competition here.
I'll never forget, Katie, one of the most bizarre fan meetings that we had was in Sydney with you, and Barry turned up, and the last thing I ever expected was to go to a Doctor Who event with Barry Crocker jumping up on stage and singing the Neighbours theme. It was completely bizarre, but so much fun.
It was bonkers, wasn't it? Absolutely it was. Bonkers. You know? And I mean, he was a huge influence on my life. I mean, I was so blessed to have played the Opera House and toured in the middle of the outback of Australia, and then also to do Banjo, which took us about 4 years to put together, which I directed. And then I directed the tour of the musical Eureka, which unfortunately never took off when it opened. I'd left it by that point. But I mean, it was just wonderful, and working with so many extraordinary Australian actors and, you know, I mean, what a life I had there. How lucky I was, because I went there with two suitcases and two sick children and one telephone number, which in a Not a Well Woman I talk about. You know, it was the most, I mean, if you just stand back and open up and receive, you know, life does some amazing things, you know. If I start to control them, it's disaster.
So how are you finding recording? Are you doing recording in lockdown now as well?
I did some filming during lockdown, which we did for the box set, which was quite difficult, which is why going back to Auburn, it didn't have the same feeling, because we couldn't really, you know, build it up. And then, you know, when I was working with Stuart and we were doing behind the sofa and banging into the plastic because I can't see it. I recorded last week, but it was just me and Tim in the studio. Everybody else is at home in their pajamas in their home studios. I had a few adventures just getting there, including a train door that malfunctioned and I couldn't get off the train. It's the actor's nightmare, and I had to wait an hour on a completely empty country station, and I'm not a country girl. I don't do country. You know, if I can't hail a cab or get a cappuccino, something's wrong.
So why were you filming in this, recording in the country?
Because a lot of the studios still haven't opened.
Right.
Because we have to, you know, rebuild and prepare for a whole new way of recording now. And this also worked because Tim lives quite close to that place, and everybody else was going to be doing it from their home studios, you know, all the posh actors.
Well, less to do.
I mean, I've done a lot on this. I mean, I even recorded the Farewell Sarah Jane video that I did for Russell T Davis. I did that in my kitchen with my phone strapped to the top of the stepladder, with, you know, books and things underneath and lots of gaffer tape, and recorded, and it worked brilliantly.
Yeah.
It's amazing what you can do if you just put your, you know. And I recorded 25 letters with David Benson, just on my little phone, and he recorded them at home. So we've been, you know, doing what we can, and also things that we did for, to help people, to raise money for charity and things like that. You know, so this little phone may have has stood me in great stead.
So what's your usual procedure in terms of getting ready for a studio? If you're going in to record something, what's your procedure to get organised?
I think you might be asking the wrong woman here.
You must do something.
I didn't plan that I would have a situation whereby I arrived at the station to, you know, I get up really, and one thing I don't do is late. That's the one thing I don't do is late. You know, when you think of all the years that I've been in theatre, even some of them where I've been sleeping in the hospital with the children and then getting to the show, I do not do late. However, things do happen, you know, and as I say, the other day, I just feel very excited, very happy, and I like to, you know, plenty of time. I'd rather get somewhere an hour early than be dashing, whereas that's where Barry and I used to fight a lot. He would always leave everything to the last minute, and I used to just say, well, I'm leaving without you. I want my calm time. I think you have to get into a studio with a blank canvas because you're going to paint these characters. And I can't do that last minute thing. I want to be totally focused and have had that time to have lost who I am, left her outside, and all the problems that may come with her, they're outside. But things do happen quite often, but that allows you the time for them to happen in. And that's something that's really, really important to me. I mean, I may seem a little bit wacky, but I'm actually much more in control when it comes to going to work. And I do an awful lot of work, as much as I can, given how long I get the script ahead. Sometimes I get the scripts just a couple of days ahead, you know, and I work very hard on, you know, making sure that the rhythms are right, and if I'm playing Joe, that what is being said is exactly how she would say it. If I'm playing anybody else, then you go with what the writer's given you. But when you've played a character for as long as I have, you do know exactly her rhythms, her reactions, and so on.
We chatted with Louise Jamison a few months back, and she was talking about directing you. I think it was her first directing gig. She had a Big Finish, and she was...
Yeah, they wanted her to practice on me.
Well, they just thought you'd be easy. And she said that while you were in the booth, it was just sheer brilliance. Like, you step inside the booth, you get a microphone, and then what you produced was just amazing. And she felt she was not doing her job properly because there's nothing to do because you were so talented and just you imbue the character. But she said the hardest job as a director was to get you into the booth. So are you really hard to get into the booth?
Yeah, very hard to get into the booth, darling, due to my size. Well, you know, it's that energy that you pick up from every, you know, people around you. But once I'm in there, that's it. And that's very kind of her to say that, you know. I really appreciate it. And I loved being directed by her. But yeah, you know, I'm a hugger. I'm a chatter. I'm a, you know, and that's another thing. You know, I think because I grew up as a child that didn't see, and it took them 5 years because nobody realized, because of the way that I was really clever. I mean, I didn't know anything else. And so, you know, your children work very close to things, and, you know, you don't really. And until we got a television, and I went boing to see it. My parents went, I think you know what's wrong. So sound has always been my friend. I sleep all night with Radio 4 X1, which is just plays and things like, and documentary. I can't sleep in silence. Sound is life to me. Silence kind of, I start listening. What can I hear? Because it's how I get through. It's how I get around. It's just so vital to me. And I love people's voices. I really do. Yeah.
When did you start developing voices and characters? How old was that? Late in life or early in life? When did it become?
Frighteningly early, because once again, I was the child that, you know, I used to talk to myself apparently all the time. And I used to hear a sound and I'd try and mimic it. I could whistle before I could talk because I whistled, and I'm really weird. And then I started finding I could make really strange noises. I used to sit in the bath making really weird noises and seeing and hearing the sounds that would come from me. And then I think I was about six when I was watching Popeye, and I started to do Popeye. And I think my parents thought, my God, we've given birth to Damien. You know, I mean, because this little tiny child with these glasses that had to be sticky taped behind her ears, right, was sitting there going, you know, that's pretty weird to hear a small child. And then I started to hear other actors and things. And I remember I was really young when I could do, I'm trying to think of her name as I'm talking, Eartha Kitt. Because I'd seen her on something on television, like, I found this wobbly, and I thought, right, I can do that. And then my father used to love it, and we would recite things like, there's a famous seaside place called Blackpool that's noted. And so I started to do, you know, and so it's been with me all the time. I didn't have any friends. I just played them all myself.
Don't believe that for a moment.
You probably don't.
John Pertwee, I mean, he's a large part of his career was radio and sound. Had you done much radio work before you started acting in terms of on stage, on film?
No, I haven't done any radio, but I listen to it all the time. And, you know, once again, I've always loved, you know, television, radio, anything that speaks. And, of course, John encouraged me hugely with voices. So we had the best time when we were traveling together, making voices to bed, putting them to various strange little, you know, how we name the weirdest towns in this, you know, villages. And as you're driving up, we had the best time, you know, vocalizing together and making up voices. And we used to have different characters that we used to play on the long car journeys and when we were sitting at lunchtime and so on. And he encouraged me hugely. And then I remember, you know, Barry Crocker saying to me, you do all these voices, why don't you add them to what you do as an actress? I said, oh, don't be silly, I just do them to make everybody laugh. And John had said the same to me. And I said, no, I just do it for fun. And the rest is history, you know, because I'd never thought about doing it as a voiceover person. And then I remember when I first joined a voiceover agency, RMK, in Australia, and I remember the lovely man who ran it, John, and he said, we don't know how to market you, so we're going to go with the voice you want, the voice you get when you don't know what you want.
Yeah. I remember your voice all the time because I'll tell you what station was it? It was the BBC station, the British station on Foxtel. Ah, you're the voice person for us.
UK TV, wasn't it?
Yeah, UK TV.
I created that rhythmic. And welcome to UK TV. Coming up next. I have many voices here. But it felt so right because it was English. You know? So I thought, yes, I'll do my sultry British voice.
So do you enjoy going back to play Joe Grant, or do you actually enjoy more other characters? I mean, you know, it was Iris Ride-Time, but then you've played characters on Dorian Gray and Dracula, Gallifrey. Do you prefer the roles where people don't know who you are, or is this a particular warmth in going to particular characters?
I'm really bad. I always answer questions in the moment, and then I think, maybe I didn't think that, because I change my mind about everything every day. you know, because I'm always learning.
Yep.
You know, so what you know, when people say, oh, in 1977, you said that. I said, that was in 97. Do you think probably by, you know, 3 days later, I changed my mind, but you've already written it down, you know. So you can't be held. But I actually like doing voices where nobody knows who I am. But my heart, obviously, is very strongly in Joe. There's a very big piece of my heart that loves playing her because I really liked Joe. I thought she was a funny, wacky, wonderful, brave, you know, strange little creature. I love playing Joe Jones. That's something I absolutely adore because I love that, you know, Russell took her through her life in exactly the right way. That's exactly what would have happened, you know. And I like who Joe has become because you can see the old Joe, but you can see what the life that she's lived, and you just knew it was the right life for her. And, you know, when you're playing her, you know, you've had to take who she was, the essence of who she was at like 19, 20, 21, and then take it and still have that Joe there, but also a mother of seven and, you know, so on and so forth, and 13 grandchildren and chaining herself to Robert. So, you know, that was a very interesting, quite frightening journey when I first did it. Like, how am I going to do this? But I do love doing voices that people don't really know about. But then I want to tell them about it when they don't know about it. I think I like the challenges too. You know, it's like as an actress, I've never been an actress who's particularly chased. Hello, this is me. Hello, here I am. I've never thought what's a good career move. You know, I just kind of feel so blessed and so lucky to be able to do what I do and get away with it, to do what I do. And it's not about being recognized for it. It's about the absolute joy of doing it and then finding out people have enjoyed it, you know.
From Big Finish Productions.
Do you really think it's not safe?
My dear Joe, if the place does go up, it's liable to be with an explosion so large, we couldn't outrun it now if we tried.
Doctor Who, The Third Doctor Adventures, Volume 6.
Oh, great.
Activate!
We will bring this country to its knees.
My willing servants, heed my words and I shall tell you what you must do. I shall tell you how to win this war.
I very much like your cape. You cut a dash, sir. You have quite a silhouette.
Mr. Churchill, it's an honour.
And you, madam, must be Joe Grant.
We are going to take the fight to the enemy and make them regret the day they ever came here. The Daleks will rule the day, mark my words.
Your companion will be submitted to robotization.
No. I assumed you'd want to see one of our core security measures in practice.
Well, it does sound very effective.
See, your sergeant has an open mind on progress.
Yes, I'm sure you're a shining example to us all, Benton.
Yes, sir. Sorry, sir.
And I know one thing.
What?
The universe would be a much worse place without him. So I'm not just doing it for me or the Doctor. I'm doing it for everyone he's ever helped and everyone he's going to help in the future.
Now, here's what I want you all to do. First, we need to find a Dalek.
These words are meaningless.
Your commander won't want me killed. Scanlan.
This is the Dalek Supreme. Prepare for the invasion of Earth. You will obey!
He hung up on me!
We'll have less of that extermination from you lot, thank you!
Carry on, Sergeant.
Dismissed!
Big Finish. We love stories.
You dropped Liza Minnelli's name earlier when you were in LA.
I tried not, but it's really hard because it's such a big part of my life, you know?
Well, I mean, I'm a giant Liza fan. I was just wondering... I mean, did you meet at school? Is that the story in terms of how you two met? But it seems like a long-term relationship.
Oh, God, it's the longest friendship I have because I didn't go to school like a lot of people do. So you have your friends right till you're 16 or 20, you know, when you leave school, 18, whatever it is. So we met like when we were like 12, just turning 12. And that's a long friendship, you know, and it's been a very, you know, she's a godparent. We've been through so many. We went through that terribly difficult, traumatic teenage time together. But, you know, as I try to explain to people, I meet all these famous people. If I start dropping names, you know, we're going to lose the floor here. But when you're growing up at that age, especially being born with only famous sportsmen around me, which was my home life, my father, you know, we used to have just 6 o'clock in the morning. We still had all these, you know. And so to me, it's just the life that you live. So when I was with Liza, we were so busy being teenagers. We weren't walking around going, oh, gosh, that sounds, oh, it's Frank Sinatra. Those are just people that are there. You know, but because people are fans, they automatically don't understand why I'm not going, oh, gosh, we had tea with Noel Coward, which I talked about. And I've told this story. And Liza and I are sitting there looking at the Savoy. And we're sitting there thinking, would it be rude to take the last? And can we split it? But we're not saying that. We're both trying to communicate. And yet, you know, years later, I'm doing plays by Noel Coward. Of course, I'm, you know, brilliant. But you're not thinking that. You don't sit. They're just the people that were in my life. And, you know, and that went on and on. You know, when I went to Vegas with Mama and Liza and everything. And we were so busy trying to do really stupid things together, like, you know, putting out, to make ourselves feel, we'd be putting out, like, announcements, you know, have you seen da 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 da? And then when we were staying at the Savoy, we were doing things like swapping the shoes outside people's doors and wheeling each other up and down the corridor in a laundry basket. You know, it not walking around saying all the people that you meet, but it must have had some sort of effect on me somewhere along the way.
Recently, I can't remember how long, maybe in the last 5 years sometime, there's been a movie version of Peter Allen's life made here. Yeah. And I was watching that looking out for someone playing you in that, but I didn't see you pop up in it.
Well, no, because I always want to be in the background. It's not, you know, I'm not there myself. Also, you have to remember, I cooked really well. I mean, we had a great friendship because Judy also, you know, when there was two of them, Judy thought it would be great that I went off with the other one, you know, because we were getting a little, really? You know, it was wonderful. But, you know, I don't like, I'm not that person who pushed. And Liza, as you know, will not watch anything that it goes out about her mother.
Okay.
I saw The Boy from Oz in Australia several times with wonderful, he was so good in it.
Dancing with the Stars.
Come on, think, boys. He's very famous in Australia. He was brilliant and did the original Boy from Oz. Anyway, he was absolutely brilliant. But, there's a lot of stuff that goes out about Judy, and it always dwells on the negative, those sides of it, because unfortunately we live in a society where everybody wants that kind of stuff.
In Toby actual Kenny.
There you go. He was brilliant. And, of course, we knew him, through Barry and so on. But, the negativity, and whereas I knew this other side as well, this amazing woman who was funny. She was mama. When we were naughty, we were in trouble, I spent to go to each other's houses when my parents were away or her, she was married to Sid Luft then. There was this other extraordinary woman, and we never get to see the humor and the wonderfulness of her being this mother. We always get what everybody seems to demand. We want all the other stuff. Whereas I will always take with me the wonderful memories of how extraordinary she was as mama,
So what was the influence in you becoming an actress? Was it because of those connections? Because why did you decide to go onto stage?
No, not really. I mean, I did an interview the other day and I kind of forgot. People said, oh, did you always want to do it? No, I wanted to be everything. I wanted to be dentist. I wanted to be a ballerina. I wanted to be, so many things I wanted to do. I wanted to be, somebody working with animals or so many things. But apparently everybody always saw it in me. I just didn't see it in myself because I didn't put a cap on what I wanted to do. I just did everything, whatever I wanted to, and it was always in the shape of voice characters, but I did forget to tell them that when I was very young at school, I was so bad at sports because I couldn't see, and because they had to tape my glasses, were so heavy behind my ears, it made me absolutely useless. And I remember when I played hockey and I couldn't see anything, and the hockey pads came up to my armpits because I was so small, and all the girls used to come running at me with sticks, and I was like, would shake, put me in goal. Anyway, we had a very clever gym mistress who said, took me out, and I played Alice in Alice in Wonderland, and then I played Bashful in Snow White. And then years later, when I was about 13, we were outside this theatre in Shepherd's Bush, had like auditions for young people. And there's all these kids going in their little party frocks with their beautiful curly hair. And Liza would say to me, "Can you do it?" I said, "Don't be ridiculous, I can't do anything." And she said, "Yes, you can." I said, "No, I can't." And I'm there in a duffel coat, big thick glasses, band the bomb badge and knee socks, right? And so she said, "Man, do it." I said, "But what?" She said, "Just think of something, but do it." So I went in and I followed all these lovely little girls with their beautiful ringlets and who were singing so prettily. So I stood there and they said, "Your name?" And I said, "Katie Manning." And they said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm going to recite." Well, you could hear them all going, "Oh, no. Oh, a child with thick glasses that's going to recite. This is awful." You have to remember, glasses were not considered cool back then. Anyway, so I took my glasses off and I stood there and I went, "There's a famous seashack place called Black Bull." And I went through the whole of Albert and the Lion, right, which you may or may not know. "That's noted for fresh air and fun, where Mr. and Mrs. Ramsbottom took young Albert, their son," and it goes on. Anyway, the lion eats Albert. And so I did, and all I could hear was, there was absolute silence from the judges, but you could hear Liza crying with laughter at the back of the theatre. So at that point, it never crossed my mind, "Oh, maybe I want to be an actress." And that carried on right through to going to America, being offered a contract, which I wasn't looking for. I was at a party. My beautiful sister Jane was a top model in New York. Anyway, I was offered, this chap saw me there and my parents were flying over to sign a contract for 5 years with MGM, which I decided I didn't want to do. And I came back and I didn't tell anybody. I just thought, I think I'd like to go to drama school. And so I auditioned and I thought, well, whoever takes me gets me. And then I said to my parents, I auditioned for drama school and I got in. So that's what I did. So it didn't, there was never this plan, you know. And I look at all these, you know, and I never feel, it's true. I mean, I've never felt, oh gosh, I'm good at anything. I just love it so much. And I give my heart and soul to everything I do. And I go and I watch, I see everything Lou does and everything that everybody does. I'm always learning from everybody else. And maybe one day I'll do something really amazing. You never know.
Oh, more amazing, I'm sure. Well, Katie, can I just say, it's been just lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
I've answered your questions properly.
Is there a proper answer? I don't think there's such a thing as a proper answer, is there? There's the answer for now, as you just said, and it may all change in a day's time.
Well, yeah, some of it may change in a day. Let's put it this way. I think opinions are very dangerous because opinions, you know, when you lock yourself into one opinion, you're not looking outside and learning more to see, because our opinions are only learned from what we hear, what we see, what papers we read, what social media, what, you know what I mean? And I'm always looking to not have deeply strong opinions. That doesn't mean I don't have huge compassion and care about certain causes. But opinions can change. But, I think care and empathy towards other people and anything that's wrong, because my father was a writer of wrongs, if you like, for want of other words, and he campaigned to make so many changes, and I think that's in me, but I don't shout about it. It's, you know, things are heard better when said quietly.
One thing that you do and you have done is that you've thrown out so much gratitude into the world, and especially to us fans. Can I just take the opportunity now to reflect that gratitude back at you? Thank you so much for everything that you've done for us too over the years. It's been amazing for us too.
Oh, I felt a bit teary when you said that.
Oh, sorry.
No, in a nice way, you know, thank you so much. But, you know, it really is. I don't think... You know, I've been to a lot of the big conventions, you know, where they have lots of different shows and, you know, nice fans. But there's something so magical about the Doctor Who fans. There's something so extraordinary, and they mean so much to me. They really do. And that's why when I do a convention, I will go without lunch. I won't even go to the loo, because I want to hug and hold every single one of them and listen to their stories. You know, it means so much to me. And I think we generally do more of that in the world, don't you? I think we should listen to other people more rather than wanting to put our opinions across or whatever. I think we all need on this planet to listen to each other more. I think the whole of this planet should be more like a whole collection of Doctor Who fans getting together, and, you know, the positivity and the strength and the wonderment that I have found through being in that show. I'm always grateful. So thank you for giving some back, but I'm just going to keep giving as much as I can out to everybody, because you're all wonderful and you mean so much to me. You really, really do. I mean, I wouldn't have swirling eyeballs and doing all that Twitter and all that stuff if it didn't really mean that much to me. You know, it really, really does. So thank you.
Sorry to keep you waiting.
Not at all.
Barely a moment to myself. Have you ordered?
From Big Finish Productions, The War Master, Killing Time.
Perhaps the time has come for you to head back to Gallifrey and admit defeat.
Defeat? The streets boil with panic. They whisper the Empress has gone mad. I'm needed here more than ever.
They think that the Empire is falling. It is not. It will continue. And so will I.
We need to move now. If she's to be overthrown, we need to strike.
No.
No.
It is over. She's won.
Are you giving up?
I just need to go and pick up a few things.
That's not possible. You can't be. You're him. The master.
In
perish.
You took everything from me. Now it's my turn to take it from you.
Why have you come back?
Well, you once told me the truths come out when it's most convenient. Well, it's now most convenient. For me.
Big Finish. We love stories.
Well, Philip, that was a wonderful chat with Katie Manning, always so full of life and so full of gratitude. It's she's got a lot of beautiful things to say, and it's always lovely to hear from her.
I love speaking with Katie because you're never quite sure where she's going to go. And some of my plans...
That's good. Unpredictability is good.
Yes, and you know, some of the plans I had in terms of where I thought we might go, we didn't go to. But what we got was great, and it was all her. And as you say, she's just learned how to be content no matter what. And you know, no matter how bad the situation, and you know, she's miles away from her kids. She's been in lockdown. All sorts of issues are happening to her, but she's still content with who she is and trying to help others. And you've just got to admire that in her.
Absolutely. So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Katie, and we're very pleased to be able to share that with you. So thanks for listening. Now, it's time for some reviews, something audio that we've been listening to, and it's actually, believe it or not, it's your turn, Philip.
Is it really? Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Okay, my turn then. I'm actually going to recommend, we're talking about it quite a bit in the interview, but can I really recommend you listen to Not a Well Woman by Katie Manning, starring Katie Manning in 26 different roles. On the Big Finish website, it's actually not too expensive at the moment. And it's interesting talking to Katie just then, realising when I listened to it this afternoon, a lot of it I realised was autobiographical. But speaking to Katie just now, realising even more of it is autobiographical than I'd actually realised. So it's a great listen. It's some very funny moments, some poignant moments as well. It's very Katie. Yeah, from the extremely funny, ridiculous, to the very serious, to the concern for others and passion for others. And listen to it. What about you, Duane? What are you going to recommend?
Okay, well, you know very well, Philip, that I haven't been sleeping much for some time. And I found myself just a few days ago, maybe a week or so ago now, in the middle of the night, not able to sleep. And I turned on the TV. My free-to-air is usually on the ABC. And, of course, in the early hours of the morning, they're playing Rage. And this song appeared, and the imagery of the video clip struck me. I thought, this looks very Australian. I was very interested by the themes in it. And it was quite a bizarre video clip. Not the usual kind of music that I listen to, but I really got into it. And the band is called Big Scary. They're a Melbourne-based band who've been around for about 10 years or so, and just released a brand new album called Daisy. You can find that on Spotify if you want to check it out first, or you can go to their webpage, which is bigscary.net. So you can get the LP. And the song that struck me, and it's the song that I'm going to put a clip to, the YouTube clip, in the show notes, it's called Get Out. And I recommend anyone who is interested in the imagery of the X-Files, the imagery of Twin Peaks, check out this video clip, because it's one that I've watched probably about 20 times since that night that I've saw it for the first time. And really, really cool stuff. So Melbourne band, Big Scary. That's my recommendation for this week.
I look forward to watching it.
Okay, so that's it for this time on the Sirens of Audio. Make sure to check out our website for all our other shows and other info and reviews that are up there. Sirensofaudio.com. So thanks, Philip. Been a great show.
It's been a pleasure, Dwayne. Thanks for the time.
All right. Catch you next time. You have been listening to the Sirens of Audio, Episode 64, Wild Times, with our very special guest, Katie Manning, and your hosts, Philip Edney and Dwayne Bunny. Next time on the show, we'll be speaking with cover artist and trailer producer for Big Finish, Chris Thompson, as we discuss the vital place for visual art within the audio medium. Theme music by the Jackpot Golden Boys. Email address is sirensofaudio@gmail.com. Be sure to subscribe to us on our YouTube channel. Follow us on your favourite podcatcher. Join our Facebook group by searching for the Sirens of Audio on that platform. Tweet us at Audio Sirens. And be sure to keep listening to those amazing worlds created for Doctor Who in the audio medium, because audio drama rocks!